Hello and welcome to the EUISS podcast, a conversation on foreign policy what-if scenarios. My name is Florence Gaub. I am the EUISS Deputy Director and the host of the show. And with me today is Simona Soare, our Senior Associate Analyst working on transatlantic relations. Hello, Simona.
Hi, it's a pleasure to be here.
So we are looking today at the big question, what if COVID-19 impacts the US presidential elections? We all know that on 3rd of November this year, two candidates will run for the vote of the American people, Donald Trump, the current president, and Joe Biden, the former vice president of President Barack Obama. So with you, I thought, first of all, we're going to look at what has the pandemic actually done to the US?
The data shows that the United States has been the country that's been most impacted by the COVID-19 crisis. We're looking at a figure of north of 1.5 million people that have been infected and over 100,000 deaths. And I believe that the administration revised in mid-May their estimates for the casualties. So they're expecting by August roughly 140,000 deaths as a result of COVID.
And large parts of the US went into lockdown, so the economy has also taken a hit?
Yes. The data in April showed 14.7% unemployment. Obviously, the reports on economic growth from last year and the reports from the first quarter of this year have not shown the full impact of the crisis yet in economic terms. But looking at the second quarter, which is when the economy basically almost slowed down to a bare minimum as a result of the lockdown, is where it's going to show us the full brunt of the economic impact.
So end of June, we will know.
Yes, probably July, we will know how bad this is looking. The other issue to keep in mind, though, is that the administration has been very focused and has actually been pressing states to reopen the economy, despite the fact that the numbers of casualties and people infected are not necessarily going down. Mm-hmm. And this has a lot to do with both the elections and the economy. Economic performance has been very important for this administration, and they're keen on not making the economic impact of the COVID crisis something that will be long-lasting and difficult to get over. I think that the calculus in Washington has been we can take a big hit for a very short period of time, but the moment that we try to extend that to 2-3 quarters, then it becomes a little bit more problematic to come out of.
I've seen one study that said that if the United States remain in full lockdown for 3 months, then unemployment rate would be at 30% by November. Now, of course, in November, on November 3rd, are the elections. So Trump has an interest to have a situation that is presentable enough. How has this impacted his approval rate? Because a lot of people expected him to mismanage it and therefore people to be very unhappy about him. That doesn't really look like it, does it?
His approval rate has never been great. It has never been above 50%. But of course, other presidents have been in similar situations as well. I wouldn't necessarily say that the crisis has impacted significantly his approval rate or that this will be long lasting. So we've seen him sort of variate between 43 and 48, 49% over the past 3 years. And we haven't seen a large dip yet in that approval rating as a result of COVID, meaning that probably his base is not at all dissatisfied with how he's managed the crisis. The other thing to consider is that during times of crisis, the American people have exhibited the ability to stand by their leadership as sort of the rally around the flag effect. So that could also be taken into consideration. And the crisis is far from over in the United States. So it's very difficult to say. I mean, we all have a very good impression of how this administration has handled the crisis or mishandled it. But the reality is that the crisis is not over. So we're far from being over the finish line.
One thing that I found interesting, because I looked at his approval or disapproval rates over the last almost 4 years, and it does look like his lowest moment was in August 2017, when he was much more unpopular than now. So at the moment, it's at 53.8 disapproval. And then it was 57.6, almost 4% difference. And that was at the time when Charlottesville happened. I find that interesting because it shows that a political incident has much more impact on his disapproval rate rates or approval rates than how he deals with the pandemic.
Well, that's an isolated case. It's interesting because Charlottesville had a very strong emotional as well as political impact. And the fact that the president failed to take a very clear stand against white supremacists and against racism in the United States was something that impacted his approval rating, I think. The other issue is the issue of race and structural racism in particular. This is an underlying topic, and it's something that the party supporters seem to disagree very much on in the United States. And we're talking about Democrats seeing this as a very important, extremely important topic in every election, be it at presidential level or national or state level, whereas Republicans tend to see it as a less important issue. So that's why I think Charlottesville was very interesting in the sense that his approval rating dipped, but didn't have a lasting impact.
In the same way that we don't know if George Floyd will have a lasting impact. But I think it is interesting that that generated more emotion, obviously, because of the video and so forth, than the pandemic. Now, let's address first one thing that's been circulating on the internet, the question of, can these elections be postponed?
There are two issues here. The first one is, can elections be postponed? And the answer to that is yes, presidential elections in the United States can be postponed. The exact date is established by law by Congress, and it can only be changed this way. So in this sense, there are no legal provisions or constitutional provisions for the president himself to change the date. The other aspect related to presidential elections is the fact that the presidential term ends at noon on the 20th of January every 4 years, which means that regardless of whether we have elections or not, we will, but regardless of whether elections are held or not, President Trump's mandate ends at noon on the 20th of January 2021.
So even if Congress and Senate decide we will postpone the elections, he stops being president on the 20th of January 2021.
Okay,
and then we have the question of, he's no longer president. Who is it then? We're approaching a Claire Underwood scenario. Or you said something else.
Vape. Yes. Well, then the succession would go to the president of the Senate, the vice president. But then Mike Pence's mandate also ends. And then I believe it would go to the president of the House, Nancy Pelosi. But I believe her mandate ends before the 20th of January 2021. Which then means that it will temporarily go to the representative in Congress that is eldest.
So in other words, postponing the election doesn't really look like...
Presidential elections have never been postponed.
Never, never.
Not even during the Civil War. That was the time that it came closest to being postponed, but it hasn't.
Okay, so we think this will not happen. What will happen instead, though?
The thing to do is to manage how it happens. Most likely it will happen on time, but then there is an issue of under what circumstances. If the COVID crisis doesn't reach a plateau in the United States, cases start to go down, then it's going to be incredibly difficult to manage with a lot of people who are not going to be confident to go out and vote. The states that have held primaries so far, we've seen people standing in line for hours to vote. I think in Minneapolis, because of public health concerns, something like 90% of the precincts were actually closed. So this has a lot of impact on whether people get to vote physically or how they get to vote.
Mail or electronic voting is a possibility. Trump doesn't like it. He seems to discourage voter turnout. I mean, he says he doesn't like it because he fears fraud.
Yes.
Is that really what he has in mind, or does low voter turnout work in his favor?
In any electoral process, there's always risks related to voter fraud, right? But this is where the government authorities step in to minimize that risk and ensure that elections are free and open and fair. And they take place under the best circumstances possible where people get to exercise their right to vote. Having said that, because of the COVID crisis, we do live in exceptional circumstances. So you will have a lot of people that are already coming out and saying, we are afraid to go out and stand in line for hours to vote. We are afraid to volunteer for the election commissions and committees to oversee the vote because there are no security systems in place that will guarantee our safety and that of the other voters. When you go and vote, you're going to touch electronic voting, right? You mentioned earlier, you're going to touch a screen. What's going to happen? Are you going to have to wipe it down after every single person votes? It's going to take hours. It's just not feasible. Are people going to bring pens and they're going to handle their identity cards with gloves? Is everyone going to do that? So there are some unique challenges to how you undertake this.
You said earlier to me before you started recording that in your opinion, Trump will try to encourage or create a situation where low voter turnout is likely because it works in his advantage.
What we have seen so far in public statements, mostly on the Republican side, has been, you know, if you fear at all going out and voting, don't take the chance, don't compromise your health. The president has been known to emphasize the risks associated with voting by mail, that there is an increased risk of voter fraud. And that is somewhat true in the sense that so far in the states that have been using this voting system, we have seen approximately 5% voter fraud.
You mean 5% of votes?
5% of votes expressed by mail
turned
out to be suspicious of fraud.
Okay.
It's always a good thing to keep in mind that we're still talking about a relatively small number of people who vote by mail in the United States because voting systems depend very much on state governments. So this is something that varies across the American states. But also in the states where you have this system in place now, you're talking about roughly 100, 120,000 people voting by mail. And these are mostly people who are challenged to travel over long distances or to stand in line to vote for whatever reason. And 5% of 100 and something thousand votes suspicious of fraud could be a significant number.
If it's on a larger scale.
In the last round of elections, roughly 100,000 were asking to vote this way. But now we've had four states that had registered 1,700,000. That's an exponential increase. And with it, also the risk is exponential.
I want to ask you something about voter turnout. In Europe, we feel uncomfortable if it goes below 75%. But in the United States, they are much lower than that. So who are the people that show up to vote? And why could that be good for Trump?
I think that he has shown the ability to mobilize his core supporters to come out and vote. People go out to vote for him. This has been one of the things that we've seen in 2016. Now, there are a lot of people who are registered to vote, and most of them, like 9 out of 10 Americans, would tell you that this presidential election is very important and they want to go out and vote. And that is really, really good. But the problem is that there is a discrepancy between what people say and voter turnout, which is not terribly high.
Is it a phenomenon of the last?
This is a century-old phenomenon in U.S. presidential elections. So their voter turnout has tended to be around 60% over the past century.
There is now a potential group that might go vote this time that didn't really go so much in the last presidential elections. That's the youth, depending on how you define youth. I would say anybody under 45. Younger people, women. I mean, there are certain voters that perhaps were not as mobilized before, but that might turn up this time.
Because of the 2000 House elections, where you did see an increase in voter turnout, and you also saw an increase in young people coming out to vote, there was an expectation that this was going to last. And also a number of polls indicated that young people are interested in politics and they're interested in sort of contributing in elections and voting. Whether this is going to end up to be true in the 2020 presidential elections is still a big question mark.
Just to throw one more detail on that, the Taylor Swift effect, she came out against President Trump. I'm not sure if it was the first time, but in general, she's not somebody who takes a very political stance. She did on one previous occasion, and there was a notable uptick in voter turnout in one state. Maybe there's a Taylor Swift effect.
Taylor Swift is not the only one who's been speaking out. Superstars or actors or activists that have come out and spoken freely about this. there is an impact, but also have to take into consideration when these statements come out. If you are going to make a statement of support or disapproval of this administration now, or support for Biden now, the likelihood is not going to impact the November elections all that much. A few days in advance, then yes, it does. So timing does matter when these pop stars or celebrities come out.
What I found interesting in preparation for this podcast, when I looked at the disapproval rates of other presidents, is that I see a notable trend in the United States of unpopularity of presidents. When you look at the disapproval rates of other presidents at this time in their mandate, the super popular ones were Eisenhower, Reagan, and Nixon, basically. But essentially, Americans were never in love with George W. Bush, with Barack Obama, with Bill Clinton, in the way they were in love with previous presidents.
I'm not really sure what it is. I think that there's definitely the effect of disenchantment with politics generally. And, you know, a long period of time of very important issues coming up, and administration after administration failing to address them head on. The riots now that are very charged by social inequality and racism. This is something that's going on for decades in the United States. I was reading this morning Barack Obama's article on, okay, let's get to work on addressing these issues and working closer together rather than using violence as a way to express our frustration with how this issue has proliferated. But the reality is that not much has been done to address the issue.
So we get the impression that because the US presidential elections is a binary vote, it's either this guy or that guy, or this woman and that man, but there are many more tribes, political tribes in that sense. And this is where I find the studies done by More in Common quite interesting, who break down the United States into six different political tribes. And the biggest tribe is the frustrated majority that feels like anything they care about is being hijacked by these two extremes. But then you look at the statistics early on in the pandemic. Let me just look at that here. So this was in April, where 90% of Americans believe that we're all in it together. So this is a significant uptick, 30% up from the fall of 2018, that Americans who regard the country as very divided has dropped by 40% down to 22%. Half of Americans say that America now feels more united than before the pandemic and so forth. So do you feel that the pandemic can heal or contribute to a bit more of a move towards each other amongst American people?
Yes, but that takes a lot of effort on behalf of people as well as on behalf of the different layers of government. And one must also look at the impact of the crisis itself, which is a good incentive to think, okay, we need to rally together to overcome this. This is where sort of the Trump administration's wartime presidency narrative, right, plays in, to create this sense of we're in it together. Having said that, I don't see necessarily a strong impulse on the administration at the federal level to try to bring people together. And the narrative still tends to be more on the divisive side. The reality is Trump has little to gain by trying to bring people together. He won his first election on hyping these partisan issues. So hyping the differences between Republicans and Democrats on the economy, between the urban and the rural area as well, by hyping the differences on immigration, by hyping the differences on healthcare and others. Why would he change it now if it's something that's been proven successful for him?
So you, as a transatlantic watcher, have a very busy few months ahead of you. From when, what point onwards will you be able to feel that, okay, now I think I know who's going to be president?
It's very difficult to say, mostly because I have learned to be very circumspect of polling and traditional instruments. I've been looking a lot at the Electoral College, and I've been looking a lot at the swing states and sort of which state leans which way depending on different topics.
Can you just help me out? Which ones are the swing states?
That would be Arizona, Wyoming, Michigan, Pennsylvania, and North Carolina and Florida, I think.
Okay, so you're looking at swing states?
It's interesting to me because, for instance, Pennsylvania and Florida are very big states in terms of electoral college for this election, right? 20 and 29 electoral votes, respectively. So that's a big win by comparison to North Carolina or Michigan, you know, 10, 11, 16 votes. But those add up. And I looked at data recently that showed the Democrats were around 230 electoral votes and the Republicans were 205. But these are estimates. Again, this is based on sort of projections rather than what's going to happen in the elections. But it's interesting to play with how, depending on different issues, right, one state could sort of lean one way or another. We still have a number of states, I think. We still have about 10 states that could, again, depending on specific issues that you put forward, could lean one way or another.
So the answer is simply we won't know until the 3rd of November.
We won't know until we know. The Trump administration has been very good at keeping states sort of in line. And because so much of this election rests on the Electoral College, that's why I'm still so concerned and sort of so interested in looking at the evolution on that side, as opposed to looking strictly at the popular vote. Mm-hmm. The latest polls show Joe Biden has an advance.
10%.
Yes. Yeah. That's the latest. The ABC and Washington Post won. There are 5 different polls out this week. You can get that difference in the popular vote and still overall lose the Electoral College. Mm-hmm. You need 270 votes to win the Electoral College and become president. This is where I think people need to be very strategic in this election, not just on the popular vote, but also do not lose sight of this other aspect that is so important.
So thank you, Simona, for joining me today. I'm pretty sure you will have a lot to say over the course of 2020 on this matter.
We're preparing a big report on transatlantic relations. You yourself are a part of it.
Yes.
And I'm very much looking forward to that. And we're looking at ways of rebuilding and sort of rejuvenating the transatlantic partnership, respective of who sits in the White House.
So thanks to you for listening to us. That's it for this season of the EU ISS What If podcast.